Hello everyone, my name is Alicia. Alice as well. A lot of people do call me that because apparently it's Spanish. Alicia is Spanish for Alice, so I'm used to it all. I've been called a lot of things. It's an absolute honor and a pleasure to be here this morning. When I was asked to do something for the Al-Anon group, it was an honor and a privilege to do that because there's quite a few alcoholics in my life and quite a few areas that I've been definitely affected by alcoholism. And the amazing thing is today is that through the steps of Al-Anon and through the help of my higher power, which I call God, there's a peace and serenity that I have regardless of what's happening on the outside. And for me, my first Al-Anon meeting, when they said that they could promise peace and serenity whether the alcoholic was drinking or not. And when they told me that, I signed up because I could understand being peaceful when he was sober, but they were saying that even when he's not sober, if that happens, that that I was going to feel the power from a God of my understanding and be okay no matter what happens outside. And so that's what I'm here to share this morning. I think after this talk, we'll take a break and then do a little workshop on the steps in Al-Anon. And this morning, though, it'll be more just my story as far as the things I've been through with crazy alcoholics in my life. I spoke at a women's conference in February of last year, and it was an AA and Al-Anon conference together, and they had me be the speaker for both. And so it was the first time that I'd ever told both stories simultaneously, and it worked, I guess. In fact, that's the CD that Avar heard and asked me to come down here and speak, so I guess he liked the Al-Anon part two. It's so funny, because back in Texas, where I'm from, all of my friends are alcoholics. My husband's an alcoholic, my mother's an alcoholic, and I'm the only one who goes to Al-Anon. It's almost like they poke fun of me that you got to go to your meeting, you know, and here every single one of them has alcoholics in their life, either friends or boyfriends or girlfriends, parents, sponsees, whatever it might be, and they just don't see it that way. They think they don't need to go to Al-Anon, and just I do because I'm really sick, but and they're partially right. To be able to come do this morning, we'll see what God does. Really prayed today to just kind of have him talk, because I could probably really mess this up if I don't let him talk. So I'm from San Antonio, Texas, which is a big city. And the first alcoholic in my life was my mother. And we had a fairly normal, if it could be called normal, a fairly normal childhood for me growing up. I was raised in a Christian family. I went to private school. My father was a pastor, so I kind of had it all forced down my throat. We seemed normal on the outside, yet behind closed doors, there was a lot of chaos and drama that went on in our house. And every Sunday morning, we would go to church all dressed up and do the happy family thing where we look like we've got it all together. And then we'd come home after church, take our nice clothes off, and you know, just start being crazy again. So dysfunction in my house started very young. And by the time I was 15, I had already begun my journey into alcoholism, and I had started drinking about 14. But there was no drinking in our household. We were very strong Christians, so Christians shouldn't do that, and they upheld those rules somehow. But I am. I'm sneaking out. I'm doing all the stuff that a young alcoholic does. And about 15, my parents got divorced. And around that same time, my grandfather, my mother's dad, passed away. And so these two things together sent my mother into just this downward spiral. And she began drinking very heavily. And I almost didn't know what to do with it, because she had switched from keeping the show up, that she was good and the family was good. She had done so well for so many years to hold up that outside picture that now she's losing it and going downhill. And it was a hard thing to watch because she was a strong woman with 5 children, had worked her whole life, and yet alcohol very quickly began to tear her down. And at this time in my life, she was kind of my drinking buddy, as healthy as that is. It was cool. Mom would buy the alcohol for my friends and I, or she would be at work until late and my friends and I would be having a party, and oh, she was just the funnest mother of them all, you know, because that kind of mom is cool when you're an alcoholic. But what began to happen is the coping techniques and the survival skills that we pick up early on, as far as numbing up, not feeling, covering up, begging her to stop, and all these things that at 31 years old, oh, that sounds a lot older than 15. I'm very old now, I feel. But these were the early stages of me being affected by someone's alcoholism. My codependency began at that age, and my father was still Mr. Christian, Mr. Pastor, and missionary, and so I never hung out with him because he was very boring. So I would much rather hang out with my alcoholic mother, and so my relationship with my father just split off. I had no contact with him. And what began to happen in our household is that I became the mother, and she became the child. And some of you can probably relate to that, as the dynamics of the family is supposed to be, alcoholism can tear that apart, and I began to take care of her. And some very, very upsetting and traumatic scenes that happened in our household because of her anger and her fear and her disease. She was a miserable woman, and that would come out sideways at her children. And I know she loved us very much, and she did the best that she could do at that time. But she, this disease, alcoholism, basically stole her life, and so it therefore affected all 5 of us. And each of us had a different degree or a degree of alcoholism from mother that we had to deal with. I've got 2 older sisters who about 6 or 7 years older than I am. And before my mother and father married, apparently they were crazy wild hippies and used to drink and do all this. So I'm sure there's no crazy wild hippies in here. But that's the mother that my older sisters got to see. And then they got to see her be sober, and then they were out of the home. So then there was me, who never saw that woman, always saw the early stages of alcoholism woman, and then I moved on. Then there was a younger brother and a younger sister, and they got the brunt of it. And police to be called, ambulance. I mean, it was just an insane home. And my younger brother, his coping technique that he picked up was to hide behind Christianity. He was going to be just like my dad and always talk about God and the Word and the Lord. And, I mean, everything out of his mouth was, not that that's bad stuff, sorry. I just mean that it was almost like he didn't have his own feelings. He was just putting on the mask of Mr. Christian, and yet deep inside he was dying. And his rage and his anger at my mother was horrible. So he was affected in that way. My littlest sister, she's 20 now. She's the one that got the majority of it because she was there at the beginning stage and at the end. And she became my mother's caretaker. She would stand up for my mother no matter what anyone else would say about her or complaining about her. She would always stand up for my mother and say, no, she's a good woman, you know. And so at 20 years old today, my younger sister is still battling that. She has not gotten help yet. And so she's kind of still in that deal with my mother as far as the caretaker role. So my mother was the first alcoholic in my life. And at 17, I'll be talking about this more in the other room this evening, but at 17, I hit a telephone pole in a blackout. I was very intoxicated and almost died from that. And that night, I'm told that I came home from this party and was screaming and yelling at my mother that I just wanted to die. To want to commit suicide at 17 years old, I mean, there was a lot of darkness in there at such a young age. And my mother was intoxicated that night. Well, I can't tell you that's true or not. I don't know. But the point is, we got in a big fight. And I said, I'm leaving. I want to die. And I drove down the street. And not even half a mile down our street, I hit this telephone pole going about 45 miles an hour. And so my mother is sitting outside, and she hears the ambulance, and she knows it's me. And talk about some pain. My mother carried that up until just recently, actually, the guilt of the I should have, I could have, you know, I should have stopped her. And so that almost brought a twist in our relationship, because now she felt guilty for my car accident. So now she was over-loving, I guess, wanted to compensate by buying me things, you know, would constantly tell me how beautiful I was because my face had been fairly badly mangled. And in the back of my head, I think I maybe unconsciously, but enjoyed this, you know. At least she was being nice now. And so the sickness in our relationship just began to grow. After moving out of the house, and I went to college and dropped out of college, then moved back to San Antonio. And at this time, my now ex-husband enters my life, and go figure, he alcoholic and a drug addict. I'm gonna pick the people I'm comfortable with. But he was even better than that. He had just gotten out of prison for 5 years straight, alcohol and drug charges. Yeah. I knew he beat women because I grew up across the street from him. He had no job, no car, no money, didn't take care of the two children he already had, and he was all mine. And I laugh because some of you women would have fought me for him, you know? We are so sick that it's, oh, I want that one, you know? And I've heard it said that you can only attract as healthy as you are. Ugh. So if that was my mirror image in male form, that's where I was at that time in my life. The no self-esteem, can't speak my mind, never can say no. I mean, all these things, it was just my life, and I felt that it was normal to me. So as he enters my life, and this is not, I don't know if y'all will find this funny or not, but when I tell my story about him, I usually call him, I call him Satan. See, I didn't think it was very funny. In Texas, it's very funny. I don't know why. But it was a very dark period in my life, and physical abuse began at 6 months being together, and I stayed for 5 years. And so many people asking me, why? Why do you stay? It makes no sense. And I couldn't give them an answer. I don't have a clue why I stay. I'm at the end of our stairs with my bags packed, and I'm bruises, and I'm bleeding and wasted all at the same time. And I can't walk out the door. I could not leave. I had to stay with him. He needed me. You know, I was going to change him. I was going to fix him. And if I left, what would happen to Satan? You know? So, yeah, so 5 years I stayed. And, you know, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous talks about that we can make decisions based on self that later place us in a position to be hurt. And so what happened there was I made some decisions when I got with him based on self. First of all, I'm terrified of being alone. So there we go. I'll latch onto this loser. I wanted drugs, and he was a drug dealer, so that worked out well. But the biggest one was that I was going to change him. And his family would look at what my Wayward Souls program did, and they would be so proud of Nun Alicia, Sister Alicia, for how she changed this man. And that was my big motivating factor when I really look at it. That's why I signed up. I wanted to protect him. I wanted to change him. I wanted him to love me. I mean, all these things that I can look back and see that I did with my mother as well. So basically, I married my mother. Oh, that's scary to think about. So, at the end of the 5 years, I have a knife to my wrist, because I can't seem to leave the monster I'm married to. And the insanity that comes with this disease and the effects of the disease, the things I was trying to do, you know, the staring out the window, crying, and then when he would get home and he'd be mad, okay, okay, and I would back down, and it was a very dark time. And I don't know how I ever got away. Just one night made the decision that this is it, and when he was gone, and I was very intoxicated, so I had the courage to do it, and I just grabbed my stuff, and I finally got away. And I ended up in treatment for alcoholism in 1998. And I really didn't go to treatment to get sober. I went to get away from him because, you see, he was the problem. If I hadn't married Satan, I would be much better today. I married him, by the way, while he was in Bexar County Jail, which is San Antonio's jail. He had gotten busted by his probation officer. So you think this is very funny. So we had been together about a year and a half, and when he gets taken to jail, I decided it would be a wonderful idea if I married him while he was in jail. You know, it was very romantic. So I posed as a missionary intern, and I went up to the third floor of this jail, and there he was in his orange suit that screamed county jail on the back of it, and I was there in my little sundress, and we had about a 2-minute ceremony and did a little, you know, kiss, which was very romantic because we'd been talking through the glass, you know, for 6 months, and now we could actually kiss. So I marry him. And I think this is going to do it. This is what is going to change our relationship. If I am Mrs. Satan, that will make a difference. So for some reason, when I left the jail, I took my marriage certificate to my parents. They weren't very excited for me. And it really hurt. You know, here I'd married the man of my dreams, and they weren't proud of me. So obviously the marriage it didn't change him, and it didn't change me. It just meant that I was legally bound to him now. So at the end of 5 years when I left, I had no intention of getting sober at the time. I just knew I needed to get away from him because he was the problem. Have any of you ever done that? You know, if I leave this alcoholic, I'm sure this alcoholic will be better, you know? And so I even move. I move 60 miles away from San Antonio into this little retirement community called Kerrville, Texas. That's where I'm from. And you're basically either in recovery in that town or you are retired. That is it. You know, there's nothing else to do. So here I have secluded myself. This is going to do it. So I probably had a 50-50 shot. I was either going to move to Kerrville and pick another alcoholic, or I would move to Kerrville and pick a retired man. So I didn't go with option B. Ended up, Kirsten, that's his real name, Kirsten went back to prison at this time. And so there was nothing to contest as far as the separation. You know, we had no property. I'd lost it all to drugs, so that was easy to split that divorce. But I sent him papers while he was in prison. He signed it, and voila, I'm done. And not even 2 weeks. I mean, that would be long for me to be alone. So let's say a week and a half. I meet my now husband, and at the time, I wasn't going to any meetings as far as for my own recovery. Well, that's not true. I went to the men's halfway house meetings because they had men there. And I have found that I will use alcohol, drugs, men, sex, food, shopping. I will use anything to treat this void inside. And so at this point in my life, I had no alcohol and drugs because I was sober. And so I went to my next favorite, to men. And I was going to pick a different one this time, you know. And here I was pretty much in relapse because I had no sponsor in AA, no steps, no nothing. And I remember crawling out of my skin when I had nothing to treat this void. And looking at myself in the mirror and going, okay, we can drink. Just don't do drugs. You know, and I made a pact with myself that that's what I was going to do. Apparently I lied to myself because I ended up drinking and doing drugs that exact same night. And so I'm in relapse now, living in this retirement community. And they've hired me at the treatment center that I went through because I was such a model patient and I'm so good at acting and making you think that everything is fine. I did so well in treatment, took notes in the doctor's meetings, organized things for them. They needed me there. And a little bit of controlling every now and then to make things happen the way I thought they should. But I did such a good job that a month out of treatment, they hired me there to do the doctor's medical billing, because that is the profession I had in San Antonio. And I was fairly good at it. They didn't have anyone to do this particular doctor, so it was my gig. No one could tell me what to do, and I was in heaven because I was my own boss, so to speak. So if you can get the picture, I'm faking my way through work. I mean, I would show up just so miserable and irritable, restless discontent, the same things that the alcoholic deals with. I'm crawling out of my skin inside, and nothing is making me happy. And so when I relapsed, I thought that was at least going to take that part away, but absolutely not. And so now I'm working at a treatment center while drinking and drugging. And because I was so healthy, I attracted alcoholic number two, also my mother. He was living at the men's halfway house. So see, it paid off to go to those meetings. He was in relapse. I was in relapse. He did drugs. I did drugs. You know, so it was love again. And I began my journey of changing alcoholic number two. And is this making sense? Do you all relate to this kind of stuff? I'm a little concerned. Okay. Am I speaking slow enough? Mm-hmm. You see, I'm a cocaine addict, and I like to talk really fast, so I'm really trying to slow down so you can understand. Okay. So, we end up in this, you know, of course, we move in together immediately, like one date, and we're living together, because that's, you know, at least I would have him there with me, and I could help him as much as he needed me to. And so we move in together, and this began a four-month relapse, I guess you could say, where I'm working at this treatment center, hanging out with alcoholic number two, crawling out of my skin to put the front up that I'm okay and I have it all together. And I am an incredible actress. We were just kind of joking about that. I mean, I can make you believe anything. And it's so deep that the self-delusion is so deep that I don't even know anymore how I feel. And I don't know what's true and what's not. And I've been telling this lie for so long about who I am and how I am that I don't even know. So at the end of that four-month relapse with him, January the 11th, 1999, I walked into my first 12-step meeting. And have been sober ever since, and that's more of the story I'll share up there. But what happened is my husband now, his name is Shane, and I lost my train of thought. His name is Shane. That's the end of that story. No, okay, got it. What happened is that January 11th, for both of us, we walked into our first AA meeting, and we both picked up desire chips and began this journey. And apparently, I was under the delusion that this was it. You know, we were going to sponsor couples. We were going to go to couples workshops. We were going to have, it's going to be so good now because sobriety was involved and God would be the center of our relationship. And God, no big expectations there or nothing. I mean, I kind of set them a little high. And at about 2 months sober, I remember coming home one night and I opened the door. And we had this big stereo, and the stereo's gone. Now, being a drug addict myself, I know what that means. You know, someone needed some money, so they took an appliance. It's just what crack addicts do, I guess. So I start to realize that my little dream and this plan and how I had written the story, it was not going to work, and was absolutely devastated. I remember crying so hard that night because I'm not really through the steps in AA yet, so I'm not really connected to God, and so I'd been using Shane to fill this void, and now he's gone. And so it was just this suffocating, I didn't know what to do. And I remember crying so hard that night that I just fell on the floor, just exhausted from crying, weak in the knees from so much pain. And all I could do, because I knew if I walked out the door, I was going to get loaded, because that's what I do to treat this, you know? And I knew I didn't have that option anymore if I wanted to stay sober. So all I could do was crawl into bed, say help, and go to sleep. And I woke up the next morning and he still wasn't there. And that's where my current Al-Anon experience comes in, as far as my time with him. The disease of alcoholism in my husband, my husband's disease, has almost killed me. I have allowed it to cause so much pain and so much anxiety and so much fear, so many sleepless nights, so many days staring out the window wondering if he's dead or alive. This was not my plan, you know. My story, we were going to be a sober couple, you know. Damn it. Oh, sorry. And we would be happy. And why is he? He messed the whole thing up. So I began with my sponsor in AA, her telling me, leave him alone. Just let him go. Leave him alone. And I would do well for maybe 2 weeks. And my husband's an excellent starter. He gets to the meeting, gets the desire chip, starts the steps, clunk, and then stops. So my hope would get rebuilt each time, a new desire chip, and this time he's serious, and I would get my expectations up again that now we would be the sober couple, and he'd relapse, you know? And so my sponsor began this. We would finish the steps in AA now, and she made me go back through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and everywhere it said alcohol, I had to cross it out and write Shane, because it's the same deal. I am powerless over Shane, and my life is very unmanageable, you know? Obsessed on Shane and where he is, you know? Shane, the inside, I'm irritable, restless, discontent. It was the exact same. But I couldn't do it. I would work through the steps with her. I would listen to her guidance. At first, it started to be guidance, and then it turned into, you better, you know? And then it turned into, I'm not going to sponsor you if you'll keep doing this. Because I, like I said, 2 weeks, a month would go by, and I would let him back in. And it's been a process of slowly killing him. Because why would he ever cry out for God if he could always cry out for me? You know? Why would he have to rely on God to take care of his money and his job and his living situation when he could always count on me? And in my gut, I know that my heart was in the right place. I know my motive behind doing these things was not to kill him. Well, sometimes it might have been, but usually it was pretty, I loved him as best as I knew how to love. You know, I come to find out today that I don't even know if I really know what that word even means, you know, because the love I've had in my life has been so sick and so tainted and with motive, you know. There's just been so much that I loved him the way I could at that time. And almost every year he goes away to treatment. And what do? I pick up the pieces. I make sure his bills get paid. I tell the right story to the right person so they don't know everything about where he is and what he did. And this whole town, I mean, like I said, it's either recovery or retirement. And so I was hanging out with the recovery guys, and they would just watch me. And by this time, I am Miss Kerrville AA. You know, I've got it all together now. So how dare they think that I am not doing the right thing, you know? And I would tell them the story of our love, you know, and this is what God's will is. And it was sickening. And if this is God's will, I should get a different God, because the insanity is just getting bigger and bigger. And the pain is getting greater and greater the longer that I stay with him and the longer that I do this. And the big book talks about not being able to differentiate the true from the false. And that was my experience. I saw only what I wanted to see. I saw the good times when we did laugh and have fun. I saw the weeks that he was sober and he brought money home and, you know, he did great. I would not take off the blinders and look at the big picture because that was terrifying. And I know so well how to only deal with what I want to deal with and throw the rest out. And so I'm getting sicker and sicker. And my anxiety, physical pain. I have migraine headaches, ulcers, and I bite my cuticles. Those physical things coming out because of my internal condition, because of the pain that I'm in, it's coming out now physically. And when I had about, a year and a half? Almost 2 years sober, we were back together again, and I find out I'm pregnant. So now, I think, see, it's God's will. We are supposed to be together. Now we have a baby on the way. And so I marry alcoholic number two because that we know that works. And so I'm convinced that if we get married, you know, that'll give him a sense of purpose. And now our child will be brought into this world and a sober parents. And that one didn't work either. I was 8 months pregnant in our wedding pictures. And all I could find was a maternity dress that was gray. I couldn't even get white or cream. So that was like a foreshadowing of what this marriage was going to look like. Because apparently you're not supposed to, never mind. Okay, and in the United States, usually you wear white, you know, your first marriage, and then the colors kind of change from there. And so the next one is more of a cream. The next one, so here I am in gray, maternity. You get the picture. God was trying to say something, and I didn't listen. So in my own recovery program, I am 50 pounds pregnant and I'm miserable. I can't even waddle anymore. Can't fit my large rear end to the seats in AA, so I quit going to meetings. I fired all the women I was sponsoring that I was helping because I was focused on this and to get this out. And so now I'm not helping others. I'm so full of resentment and rage and hatred at this time for my husband. I mean, some of the things that would come out of my mouth. You have The Exorcist, the movie around here where the head spins around and vomit? That was me. I mean, I was miserable. And yet when people would call and ask how I was doing, you ready for the baby? Bless God, everything's great. Can't wait for the bundle of joy, huh? Oh, Shane's good. Yeah, thanks for asking. No, we don't need money. He's doing great. Oh my God, this was my best performance ever, you know? It was literally a double life that was killing me. On my own, by myself, I want to die. And it's not because of my own disease, it's because of the insanity around his. So the thought actually crossed my mind at that point, how come he gets to do drugs and I don't? And that terrified me, because now my child is here. My heart's desire laying in the crib next to me. That's all I've ever wanted to be as a mother. And I've got it now. But I am so lost in this disease that I can't even enjoy this child. He almost missed the birth by about an hour he was using. He went home to go take a shower after I had been induced for 12 hours and nothing was happening. And the doctor found that he had flipped around, so he was breached, and it was going to be an emergency C-section because he was huge. He was, 8 pounds, 8 ounces. So he was a big baby. And so I'm calling home 20 miles away, and he's not answering. I'm like, we're about to have this child. My picture, my happy family, you must be here for the birth. And he's nowhere to be found. And I think the fifth or sixth bawling, crying message that I left, he finally answered the phone. And he was using drugs there at our house and drinking. He wasn't drinking that night, but he made it to the hospital. I didn't know he was using. I thought he had just missed the calls, and that's the denial. I knew in my gut when he left that something wasn't right, but I'm going to act like I don't know that. You know, it's going to be okay. So he makes it to the birth, and a couple of days later, I had to have a friend come pick me up from the hospital because he was missing again, and that was my welcome home with my newborn child. My husband sitting on the couch, blasted out of his mind, and I can't even enjoy this gift that God gave me because I'm so focused and obsessed on him and what he is doing. And that just began the journey. Every year he goes to treatment, and every time I pick up the mess and I stay, you know. And when I got that miserable, I find this is the hope part. They'd been trying to get me an Al-Anon since I got sober, because at 2 months sober I was crazy around him, but I never listened until this time. And I remember the first Al-Anon meeting I sat in, where they read the welcome, and it says, peace and serenity, whether the alcoholic is sober or not. And that was the sentence that kept me there. That was the promise that they offered that I had to feel, because I could not do this. It had gotten to the point that whether he was sober or not, I wasn't happy. And that's actually the statement that got me into Al-Anon. He said, Alicia, you're not happy if I'm drunk. You're not happy if I'm sober. And I was, how dare you say that, you know? Because I am so spiritual and so connected compared to him. And my ego, I mean, it's insane, but it is so true. That's when I really knew that this had nothing to do with shame. It had everything to do with me. And I would never be able to control or change him, but I had the power to do something to change me. And just as with alcoholism, there's a bottom or a ending spot, this was it for me. I was not going to allow his disease to do this to me any longer. Or I wasn't going to allow myself to react to his disease that way. Let me put it that way. So my journey began in Al-Anon. And as my eyes began to open to this truth about myself, and that I try to control anything that's around me. I don't care if it's my son, if it's friends. I mean, I'll do it. Just give it to me, you know. And I'm Wonder Woman. I can do it all. But as my eyes began to open to my truth around this, that's when the freedom came. The more I pushed through the steps in Al-Anon, the more I realized that this was about me and not about him. The further along through this blocked channel, I've had this channel, and God was on this side and I was on this side, and I believed in him, but I couldn't feel him. And so the steps are what cleans out that channel. And the further down in the steps I get, the more freedom I have. And I began to, we have a newcomers meeting, there's a lot of meetings, but a newcomers meeting that I became my regular meeting. And so it was a constant plethora of new families coming in and going out. I work at a treatment center in Hunt, Texas, which is a little bit further away, 10 miles away from Kerrville. And they have a family program at this hospital. And all the families come every week. It's new groups, the families that come through, and they go to my Tuesday night Al-Anon meeting after they've spent all day in the program. So that became my regular meeting, and God now used this side of my life, this side of freedom that he'd given me, God now used that to help other wives and other parents. And I watched my in-laws. They're very strict, very religious, Church of Christ. I'm not sure if that's here, but in the United States, it's a, you know, no instruments, very quiet, very. I'm raised the opposite, more of the hallelujah, that kind of stuff. It's called non-denominational in the States, but that was more me, and he was raised this way. And my in-laws have been doing this with him since he was 18 years old, and he's 33 now. And they send him to treatment every year. His mother has health problems that are life-threatening, that can come from stress and worry and pain. And they believed that if Shane would just go to church every Sunday, if he would just go to church and take communion, he doesn't even have to stay for the service. What a deal, you know? They believed that if he would do that, he'd be sober. And there was nothing I could say to make them understand. That's what they wanted to believe. That was their story they were telling each other. And they still battle it, you know, with him today. So I was able to help family members, mothers and fathers, because of what I had seen my in-laws go through. I got to see for the first time what I'd put my family through in my disease. Because now I have a little boy. And I can't even imagine sitting up and wondering if Ethan was dead or alive. I mean, that's all. His name's Ethan. That's a whole different kind of love You know, a mother's love, it's a different relationship, obviously. I'm a wife. I can leave if I want to. The mother's love goes on. And so I began to see the effects of this disease just all over our whole family. And my mother ended up getting sober when I had 2 years of sobriety, and she now has 3.5 years. And she's sober, but not working the steps, really. So she's kind of what we call dry. You know, she's still selfish. She still manipulates. She's still very controlling. She's still dishonest, but she's not drinking, you know. So that's a different, really. We don't get to see each other as much as perhaps I would like. Kind of the end of this story is about every year he would go to treatment, and every year I would pick up the pieces and clean up after him and would just cry. This is while I'm in Al-Anon. I mean, I really have this gut feeling that I'm supposed to stay. One sponsor would tell me, Alicia, this is unconditional love. Another sponsor would say, are you sick? What's wrong with you? You know, and so the opinions about what I was supposed to do with my husband just would be flying all around. And the last year, his relapse, his last year, he was having to live in Phoenix, Arizona, very far away. And he lived for 6 months, and he relapsed while he was in treatment. So here, Phoenix is the only place we haven't tried yet. He's been to all the other treatment centers, from the most money to the state-funded, and now he relapses in Phoenix, and I'm just hopeless. Just forget it. And I detached with anger. Apparently you're supposed to do it with love, but I ripped my ring off and cuss words and the green stuff, and I was done. Until he came back to Texas, you know, and the first time I saw him, it was so he had 9.5 months sober in February, this February. That's the longest he's ever had since he was 18 years old. And we have an incredible son. He's amazing, and Shane's an excellent father when he's there. And I was speaking with Chris in Fort Worth, Texas, and 2 hours before I spoke, I got the call that Shane had relapsed. And you know, I thought I was doing okay until that happened, you know. I wouldn't have been alive at that time had I not gotten the connection with God through Al-Anon. The tools that I used, the boundaries, the things that I learned, I wouldn't be alive today if it weren't for Al-Anon. Al-Anon saved my sobriety. I'm very clear on that. Anyway, so just the shock. I mean, these other ones I knew his pattern. I could watch. I knew when he was about to relapse. This one, we'd never been here before. This was it. This was 9.5 months, you know? It was over. My dream finally is coming true. And he hasn't been able to stay sober ever since. And it went to 3 months, and then he relapsed, and then 2 months he would get sober, and then 1 month, and then it began to be every couple of weeks, and I'm sinking further and further down. The progress that I've made through these steps, I'm continually working with my sponsor in Al-Anon and calling her daily and still helping other women, trying to be there, but I'm dying inside. And many times crying out to God, just going, "What? If you want me to leave, I will leave. If this is the sign that I'm supposed to get out of here, I am more than happy to now. Because this wasn't fun anymore, you know, and the money problems, the chaos that alcoholism causes, you know, and I prayed once. I said, God, if Shane is not the man you have for me, then get him out of the way, because I don't want to do this anymore. And not until a couple of months ago did I finally feel the peace about leaving, and I don't know if that was just hanging on and hoping that something was going to change in my little picture of the happy family. But about 3 months ago, his disease took us to a place that we hadn't been before, and it terrified me that he was now capable of this next step. And I said, that's it. So in September, I filed for divorce, and he went to treatment again. And the gift that God has given me in this, though, is that now I can share it, you know, with other people. Without these steps of Al-Anon, I would be in my house, curled up in a ball, crying, terrified of what was going to happen in the future. Where's the money going to come from? How about Ethan? I mean, I have a tendency to do what they call catastrophize, where you tell yourself a scary story and you keep going. Well, my scary story always ends up with Ethan at his high school graduation having to say from the valedictorian stand that his mother raised him because his father died of an overdose. You know, I mean, I've told the story to myself many times. Oh, they're very interesting. I should write a book. All the scary stories we tell ourselves. But that is what I do on my own power. I sit in my house, depressed, away from everyone, writing scary stories. And I'm not doing that today. And that is not me. That is this power that Al-Anon got me connected to. That I can have peace and serenity, whether he's sober or not, whether we stay married or not. For the first time, he is in agreement that this is what we need to do or he's going to die. So usually what happens when I get angry and I'm done or I say my words that I don't follow up with, he usually comes back and does the begging and the crying and the please, don't do this, please, I'll change. And that's what I'm addicted to. I'm addicted to him needing me. So this time, he doesn't need me. So neither of us have ever been here before. I don't know. Brand new territory, you know, but my experience is that no matter what I've been through in those last 6 years, God has always shown up. I've never gone without food. My son is always healthy. I just bought a home in May. I can't afford it on my own, but I'm sure you're going to take care of that one, right? That's the kind of walking by faith deal. Okay, everything's falling apart around me. I don't know how you're going to get us out of this one, but I'm willing to let you. And the more I seek him, God, not Shane, where is he? The more I seek God and let God walk me through this, the closer our relationship gets and the better it is. And if this is the end of our story, the happy family story, then I'm okay. I'm lying. Then I'm all right with it. I'm not terrified by it. You know, it's not controlling me as it would have in the past. I love this man. I hate his disease. But I love him. And so, as cliche as it sounds, loving him enough to let him go, one of us is going to die if we don't do something. You know, and our son has been affected so much already at such a little age. He bit his way out of his first daycare. He was a little affected by alcoholism in it, too. That's the only way he knew to show his frustration and his fear. And now at 3.5, he can talk a lot more. And he wants to know why Daddy can't sleep in our house. And all we can say is, Ethan, Daddy gets sick when he lives here. He has to go live with Nana and Papa, and he'll come over all the time, you know, and try to banish. God's got Ethan too, you know. Just trust that God's got Ethan as well, you know. Listen to me. I'm trying to sound. I know if I stay on this path, the way I relate to Ethan will be even better, because I would snap at him and get frustrated with him because I'm so obsessed on Shane, you know. So I know that Al-Anon for me is going to affect my son's life, and that I will be more peaceful, and I will be able to enjoy the time that he and I have together alone. I truly believe that God let me do this as long as I want. He would let me keep staying with Shane if I wanted to. He can't make me do things. And he's just been out there watching, going, Alicia, I've got such a different plan for you if you would just let go. So here we go. I've let go. And I'm clear with the fact that it's okay that I love my husband. I hate his disease. And I'm not going to be affected by it anymore in this capacity like I had been with the money and the everything. I'm going to go on my way and continue carrying the message of hope around Al-Anon, because this is not my normal state. Can y'all relate to that? That peace and hope and serenity, that's not what we do, you know? And so because of God's grace and because of this gift of the story that he's given me in Al-Anon, I will continue showing up wherever he needs me. I will continue watching wives cry about the same situation, and I can use my experience, strength, and hope to help. And if we all continue to do that, I mean, it's just, it will spread, you know? Instead of watching the sickness and doing nothing about it, you know, we have a solution today. We have an answer today to stop the insanity that's inside and up here. I'm free of the obsession of where my husband is, where he's going, what he's doing. I'm free, and I have a lot more time on my hands now. When you don't have to control and fix everything, it's just 24 hours in a day now. I guess that's my Al-Anon story. I didn't know what God wanted to say, you know, and so I hope that something I've said or just the story in itself brings hope and peace, that I can be happy whether Shane's in my life or not, or whether he's sober or not. I'm free today. Thank you.